So when was your last checkup? Oh no, not you. Although that's important too, but when was your last vehicle checkup? When it comes to service, nobody knows your Chevy better than your local Chevy dealer. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule an appointment today.
If there's one newsman in the United States, one broadcast news fellow who's not interested in pizza, squares, or sliced, it's Leland Vitter, Washington correspondent for News Nation and host of On Balance. You got to check out his war notes, Leland Vitter's war notes, which are fascinating. And I read them all as I waited for him to show up. And what are we going to talk about today? We'll talk about Super Tuesday and Trump and how a selection of Nikki Haley as the vice president would basically force me to become a Democrat and vote for Biden. Yeah, right. And we'll also get his take because he spent years as a war correspondent and spent years on the ground in Gaza and Israel. And we'll get his take on what's going on with Israel and the United States and how domestic politics here affects our foreign policy there. And where are you as the city reels from the violent mobs that were looting the other day on Roosevelt that the city knew was coming and did nothing about? You're on the Chicago Way with Leland Vitter of News Nation and Jeff Carlin of WGN Radio and me, John Cass, on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand with pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Leland Vitter is not one of the silo journalists. He's not. You look on CNN and they're all to the left, and you look at Fox and it's mostly all to the right. Leland carves a path, independent path for himself, and that's why we like him here. Good morning, Leland.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
Handicap the Super Tuesday race.
I think at this point we're discussing by how much Trump wins everything.
I don't think it's going to be that dramatic. However, I do think that Nikki Haley does take from Trump in the long run down the road because, as you pointed out in one of your commentaries or news war notes, I think you did, that Nikki Haley is attacking him in the field of suburban women, and he needs them to survive. He needs them to win.
Well, we've definitely said that when it comes to the general election. And it's clear, as we see the realignment of the political parties, that working class voters have shifted, right, from being staunchly Democrats to now at least 50-50, if not in Donald Trump's camp. They're now Republican MAGA voters. This election, as the 2020 election was, will be decided by suburban women and college-educated whites, largely. And Nikki Haley, certainly in the primaries, enjoys the outsized support of what support she has from those two groups, suburban women and women in general, and from college-educated whites that are still represent the old guard, if you will, of the Republican Party, the sort of traditional conservatives, George W. Bush conservatives. I think the bigger question is not whether Nikki Haley will take those away, because in a general election, conceivably, she wouldn't be on the ballot. but whether either they show up or there's a lot of Nikki Haley voters, and this is what we saw when I was in Iowa and New Hampshire, to a certain extent, South Carolina. But there are Nikki Haley voters who are also Joe Biden voters. If it's not if Nikki's not going to be on the ballot in November, they're going to vote for Joe Biden, and that's a real problem for Donald Trump.
Or it sounds to me like Nikki Haley is a Democrat, and I thought she was a cheerleader of endless wars on the Republican side, but I'm now confused by Nikki Haley, and maybe that's a good thing for me.
That's the point.
Right?
I think a lot of people are confused why she's still staying in, and yeah. what it is that she wants out of this, I think, is still a question. But I wouldn't say she's a Democrat. What I would say is that she is a typical George W. Bush conservative. And that is gone now in the Republican Party.
What do you think? Do you think that group, I mean, those types, because the people who are maybe have kin themselves to that mindset, they haven't, you know, evaporated, and they haven't all changed, you know, their ways or altered their opinions. Where do you think they land in a general, who do you think would need to be the VP candidate to kind of bring that back in, a la Mike Pence?
Well, that's a great question. And you think about Mike Pence was picked to shore up the conservative Republican and evangelical vote that was very skeptical of Donald Trump.
Sure.
And Trump was extraordinarily pragmatic in who he picked as a vice president to shore up that group. And it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump's no longer weak in that area, right? He's now extraordinarily popular among conservative Republicans, or, you know, sort of the more conservative group, and extraordinarily popular among evangelical Christians. Where he's weak is with suburban women and college-educated whites. The professional class of America that has slowly shifted Democratic and then very quickly shifted Democratic in 2016. So if you take that hypothesis that I just gave you, then that would speak to somebody like a Nikki Haley as a VP pick. And everyone says, oh, she won't do it. She won't do it. She says she won't do it. Everybody says they won't do it until they do it. Okay. George H.W. Bush certainly said in 1980, he wasn't going to be Ronald Reagan's vice president. And then he was. Right. I mean, you never are until you are. So
you also said no new taxes read my lips. And then they were
not going to do it.
Not prudent.
Right.
I'll put it this way. I don't know exactly how many politicians live in Washington, but you'd be hard pressed to find a single one who hadn't said something that they went back on.
Sure. Yeah. Like flags in the wind sometimes. Well, who do you think then your top three for Trump to pick up? Obviously, Nikki Haley has an appeal, so that's out there. But do you think that's
realistic? I would give you Haley, Abbott, and Ben Carson, only because you said three. I could make a case for those three. I could make a case for another three or four, and it could be somebody totally different. I mean, I remember covering Trump in 2016, and he picked Mike Pence, and everyone went, who?
What? Yeah.
And, you know, the same with, I mean, you remember Sarah Palin in 2008. Yeah. God, everybody had to look up. People, no one even in the national media knew who the governor of Alaska was.
And they were offended that they didn't, and so they took it out on her. The coverage of Palin, I can see Russia from my house and all that. Tended to be a little over on the overkill side, no?
Sarah Palin allowed Saturday Night Live to define her. So I think you're hard pressed to find a good defense of Sarah Palin. And you know, look, at the national level.
Right.
Yeah, at the national level, and I think people forget about this, but this is a full contact sport. You're asking for George Washington's job or to be one heartbeat away from George Washington's job. And there is a level of grievance by national politicians about the media and about that this is unfair and that's unfair and on and on and on.
Right, right.
That I just find completely lacking and really weak. It's like, to me, if you want to have George Washington's job, you want to be the commander in chief, stop complaining. Stop complaining about the media coverage. Stop complaining about how unfair elections are. Stop complaining that you don't get credit for every, you know, wonderful thing you've done. Stop complaining. The American, please.
Right, absolutely. Do you think, you know, my dark horse, and I hate that term, but I don't know why I use it, it would be Sarah Huckabee, because she's done, she's really put in the work. She's, you know, been here. I mean, I haven't seen a lot of criticism outside of the left, obviously, on what she's doing in Arkansas. And do you think there's an argument there?
Sure. You can make an argument for an enormous number of people.
Sure.
If you go through the list of Sarah Sanders, Kristi Noem, Carrie Lake, not that all of them are the same people, and I know and have a lot of, you know, affinity for Sarah. I think she's a really remarkable woman, and like her father, who I know and have covered for 15 or 20 years, I really have good feelings about as a person. But none of them solve Trump's problem with swing voters. Yeah. All of those picks speak to the base. Which is fine, but that shoring up and energizing the base is not a problem. And look, we saw that in Iowa, and we saw it in New Hampshire, and we saw it in South Carolina with the well, maybe not so much in Iowa, but certainly in South Carolina and certainly in New Hampshire with the turnout numbers in the primary. The Republican primary electorate is really energized. They're angry. They're fired up. The Democratic base is not. The Republican base is.
One thing about Nikki Haley is that many of the people who support her, I'm looking at a list from Forbes, are Trump critics like Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn co-founder, and many others. So basically, they don't like Trump. I understand their viewpoint. And then they use Nikki Haley as their vessel to undercut him. Okay, fine. That's politics. That's hardball politics. But whenever you do something, there's a reaction to it. Where's the downside of undercutting Trump at a time when half of the media is his cheerleader and half of the media is his enemy? So really a great deal of support for Nikki Haley editorially. I don't see the downside to her undercutting him. And so I think she'll continue as long as the money's there, no?
That's the great parlor game in D.C., of course. When's Nikki Haley going to drop out? And, you know, she says she's not going to. And she's, I think her line was, as long as 70% of Americans want an alternative, to Trump and Biden, I'm going to give them one.
Right.
It's an interesting line. Yeah. Okay. As you point out, people leave political contests for two reasons. They run out of money or they can't take the ego hit. And she doesn't appear to care about the ego hit. You rightly point out that there's a media contingent that enjoys this. I think Nikki Haley is sort of what liberals view as an acceptable conservative, so that they're not just against all conservatives, but like, well, Nikki Haley's an acceptable one, although I did hear a couple of...
I would say she's acceptable Republican, not a conservative, but anyway, that's true.
Okay, fair enough. She's an acceptable Republican. I'm not sure you can call Donald Trump a conservative. Certainly not in the traditional sense of the word, but
no, transactionalist Donald Trump.
Fair enough. The media likes her, and I think the media also likes, if we're doing this, there is a feeling that when you're talking about Haley Trump, there's someone taking on Donald Trump other than Joe Biden. So rather than forcing a conversation right now about Trump Biden and Biden's weaknesses and Biden's vulnerabilities, then they get to talk about and hit Trump with Nikki Haley rather than with issues that Joe Biden has.
Exactly. 100%. I agree with that. 100%.
Leland, so I'd love to kind of pivot a little here, if that's cool with you guys. I mean, like you said, this is all up in the air, and this is going to come out in the wash soon enough. But as we tape this, there's been obviously craziness happening in the Middle East and Israel and Gaza. And you were there. I mean, you were on the ground there for what, 4 years back in the day? Not back in the day, but
correct.
What's your read right now, this moment, as people keep talking about, you know, there might be a peace deal or not necessarily a peace deal, a ceasefire, where do you see things?
I see things that it is absurd to think about blaming Israel or putting the thumbscrews to Israel on a ceasefire deal when Hamas will not even release a list of living hostages or provide proof of life. And that shows you where Hamas is in this situation, number one. Number two, there was a ceasefire on October 6th. So keep in mind who did this. And for all of the discussion about the plights of the Palestinians and the difficulty that they are going through right now in Gaza, and there is unquestionably human suffering on a very difficult level in Gaza, Hamas is responsible for that. Hamas is the one stealing the aid. A ceasefire doesn't solve that problem. If the administration really cared about the Palestinians rather than about Arab voters in Michigan, they would say the best thing that can happen to the Palestinians is for Hamas to be destroyed. And since the Palestinians can't do it on their own, the civilians, then Israel's going to do it for them. And that is the best way to ensure a quality of life and safety and prosperity for the Palestinian people. The dirty little secret to that is that it presupposes that things are going to work out well without Hamas, that it presupposes the administration's long talking point that, oh, you know, very few people in Gaza support Hamas. Well, hogwash.
Right.
It's well north of 50%, if not higher. I think the number is 70% of Palestinians at all support armed conflict and resistance against Israel. Well, you can't have peace with people who don't want peace. Israel has offered, I think it's now up to 6, if not 9 different times, going all the way back to 1948, for a peaceful coexistence of a Arab Muslim state and a Jewish Israeli state. Okay, which is what we're talking about. Right. The Palestinians, or the term Palestinians, is a media invention. And every time, either the Arab coalition, the Arab League, or the Palestinians themselves through their leadership have turned it down. The 1980s are calling and want their Middle East policy back, and Joe Biden is sitting there living in that world. If only we can have a two-state solution, then everything's going to be fine. That doesn't exist anymore. And is the Netanyahu government phenomenal and great and good people and on and on and on? Not necessarily. Oh. But they're realists about what's happening there. And the Arab world, and specifically the Palestinians themselves, are not honest brokers in this. And you can't have a good deal with bad people, which not all Palestinians are bad people, but the majority of them want Israel wiped off the face of the earth, so I'll redefine it. You can't have a peace deal with people who want to kill you.
Yeah.
Sounds like gold in my ear to me. Sounds exactly like what she said, but that's true. You can't negotiate. It's difficult, if not impossible, to negotiate with people that want to cut your throat. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Well, you can negotiate with people. What Golda Meir's great line was, we will have peace when the Palestinians love their children more than they hate us.
Yeah.
And she was right. Yeah. When the Palestinians, you know, Gaza over the past 20 years, Gaza et al. Has been given enough money to turn it into a Middle East version of Singapore, or certainly of Dubai. Okay. And rather than take that money and build skyscrapers and build an airport and build additional greenhouses to export fruit, which you can grow very easily in Gaza, and to build industry, to build infrastructure, they ripped up the water pipes to make rockets, and they used all the concrete to build tunnels for Hamas rather than buildings. Okay, but we have to, when we're talking about this, facts matter. Yeah. And I think that's something that, for political expediency, the White House is ignoring. I think they're ignoring it to their own peril.
This week, they're having Vice President Kamala Harris sit down with Benny Gantz, I believe, the opposition opponent to Netanyahu. How does that work out? How do you think that is? That wise, and is it a good thing that they're doing? Or
I'll put it this way: I know Benjamin Netanyahu. Okay, if you want to try to out politic and outflank Benjamin Netanyahu with Kamala Harris, is Joe Biden would say good luck in your senior year. And really, that is like having the Evanston High School football offense go up against the Bears defense. That is not a competition. It shows really the arrogance of the Biden foreign policy team, which was the Obama foreign policy team, lack of understanding of how good Netanyahu is at what he does. Again, if the administration really cared about trying to help the Palestinians, what they would be saying is, we hold Hamas responsible for the plight of the Palestinians. Give us, meaning America, our hostages back. When was the last time you heard Kamala Harris or Joe Biden mention the hostages, American hostages that are still being held? And give Israel its hostages back. And you tell the Qataris and the Turks to turn off the money and the protection for Hamas. And then we can have a real conversation about how to instill some kind of government in Gaza that can help the people who are there. But it's very difficult to help people, and you see all these photo op airdrops of aid into Gaza. And those are the most expensive Cheerios that have ever existed in life. Right. And the reason for that, isn't because it's going to help Gazans, not be hungry. All that does is try and allow the administration to go back to the Arab constituency in Dearborn and in Georgia, where they're losing support, say, look, we're doing something. Well, what you don't see is that almost all that aid is stolen by Hamas. Okay, so
you mentioned that the other day. Yeah, you mentioned that the other day in one of your Leland War Notes. They steal
warnotes.com to subscribe. All the aid is stolen by Hamas. And the other part of this reason is, one of the reasons that they can't bring aid in by truck into the Gaza Strip is they can't find truckers to drive into Gaza because they are beaten and assaulted, and their trucks are destroyed by Hamas gunmen who are stealing the aid.
You can't win there. And we saw that, that incident that happened last Thursday, and that was instantly reported as and blatantly ignored, objective observers on the ground saying this was, really more about a swarm to overtaking trucks, and then the chaos that ensued after the checkpoint opened fire. And but all the headlines read open fire, killing. And you're like, well, no, that was open fire. Sure, that happened, but there was more to it, and that was driving me insane just to see that. And we've seen it, John, you and I talk about all the time. It's this one sided, this narrative building. But to that point, and to kind of bring it back to DC. You mentioned the Arab constituents in Michigan and whatnot, but I feel, and seeing what I see from younger people, they think, and we've seen it on these campuses, that Gaza is the underdog here, and Gazans, and that if you're not for them, you're not for helping them, you're part of the enemy. Do you think that's a part of this play too? Do you think Biden's trying to key in on some younger voters? I know they don't necessarily vote all the time, so it's kind of a weird conversation to have even, but do you think that's part of it? Their gamesmanship there is to try to pull in some of these younger voters.
Sure. What is it? 50% of those between 18 and 24 view Hamas favorably and more favorably than Israel, or support Hamas. I can't exactly remember how the question was asked, but it's something right there. Yeah, but that goes back to a much larger conversation, right? About an intersectional hierarchy of grievance, and those who are the oppressed and the oppressors, and this new worldview, sort of a neo-Marxist worldview, that those who are less fortunate must have been oppressed by people who are more fortunate, or the oppressors, and anything the oppressed do is by definition virtuous because they are being oppressed and they're fighting against the oppressors. It's how we got to, hey, it's okay to loot and riot in the streets of Chicago right. and other cities because somehow if police officers are mean to a certain group of people, then that group of people is now free to do whatever they want. Was the argument. Mm-hmm. It's a very similar neo-Marxist worldview that is now being taught. And look, anti-Semitism is the oldest form of hate in the world. And what I would argue is we've moved from what, you know, we used to consider anti-Semitism, which was, hey, people didn't get into a country club, or you couldn't stay at a hotel, or you couldn't live in a neighborhood because you were Jewish, to a form of, if you want to call it anti-Semitism, that the Nazis had, which was, we're going to kill people because of this. And that's a very different worldview than has existed in the past.
Does that play, you think, in this election at all? I mean, or even more broadly with people beyond that, you know, 18 to 26 worldview?
I would argue, and to circle this all the way back to the beginning of the conversation,
right.
is this has a lot more to do with the divide in American politics now that is no longer necessarily red versus blue, but it's traditional versus progressive values that now define people. It used to be that you picked where you stood on the issues and now you pick your party. It's gone the other way.
Yeah.
There is a progressive worldview that views Israel as the oppressors and Palestinians as the victims, and therefore the Palestinians can do whatever they want. That's the progressive worldview.
It looks to me, if we're going to just have one more bite at this apple, that the Israelis are not fools. Benjamin Netanyahu is not a fool, and neither are his opponents in Israel, but they all should have seen and would have seen and probably did see this coming, right, Leland? I mean, they saw the cultural shifts and what was done to stop it or to address it other than to run a few, you know, commercials about visit Israel and dance and have fun. I mean, where was the express counterattack to this propaganda war?
I don't think anyone saw what was happening on America's college campuses. I think in much the October 7th attacks were a complete surprise. And the concept that Hamas was planning it and could carry it out was a complete surprise. The black swan, if you will.
Right.
The level of anti-Semitism that exploded in America, not necessarily in Europe or in Australia, but in America and on America's college campuses and on the streets of America, came as a complete surprise to the Israelis and to Jews in America who have largely supported progressive causes, including Black Lives Matter, that then posted a picture of a paraglider coming in on October 7th. So
yeah.
With friends like these, who needs enemies?
For sure. Well, Leland, we're going to let you go because it's a busy day in D.C. It's Mondays we tape this, and you are prolific, as John and I were talking before. And what you do, people got to catch you on Balance on News Nation. It's, you know, if you're tired of getting yelled at from the other media outlets, this one will at least let you see both sides and see them clearly and check them out on Twitter. And of course, the War Notes is fantastic. Fantastic.
Warnotes.com to subscribe. It's free, 4 p.m. You get our thoughts on the most important stories of the day.
Thanks, Leland. Thanks for being here.
Thanks. Talk to you soon.
See you. We have to have him back to talk about his sister's cooking because of that's fantastic.
Right.
But yeah, and you never would think that the Scottish people were, you know, would be interested in cuisine other than salmon and haggis, but they do.
They're evolving, John. They're a complex people.
Just like Ireland, yeah.
And yeah, for those who don't know, Leland Vittert's sister is like a Harvard-educated professional who also has an amazing cooking pedigree.
Statistician and brilliant.
Yeah, brilliant
woman.
Mind. Yeah. If you think Leland's impressive, you should follow his sister. I mean, I think
their parents are impressive.
Sure, yeah. Liberty Vittert is Leland's sister's name, so check her out too.
So,
closing notes there, John?
Yes. You got anything? Well, I just would say it's good to get out of the silo. But if Donald Trump wants to turn me into a Democrat, he will put Nikki Haley on the ticket, because I see that woman and all I see is the masters of war, like Dylan singing that song.
Yeah.
And body bags and coffins.
Yeah, that's, but that military, you know, the military industrial complex is still alive and well in this country. And, you know, I think they have a font to touch the president through Nikki Haley. If he's going to run and try to beat Biden, you know, that might not be a bad thing.
When you they're already giving us more than we can handle. Like, they're now apparently white people are to be despised and attacked. If you're a rural white person, according to the new book that's out there, it's the Philippic, a hateful diatribe by two journalists.
Yeah. White rural rage.
White rural rage. This is the, you know, when here's how you want to put people up and drive them into trucks and take them off to the re-education camp. What you do is first you define them as enemies of the state. And that's, you know, and that's how you do it. So maybe we need a Uyghur camp for them, right? All those white guys who fight in the wars that Nikki Haley supports. Anyway, for Leland Bittert, correspondent and anchor for News Nation and author of New War Notes, he is quite prolific. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, friend of Cat's, future physics teacher. And Jeff, can we do some science stories? Because, you know, this politics is depressing. I'd rather talk about black holes, you know, swallowing us up. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, Greek Orthodox Christian, editor-in-chief of johncassnews.com, where you can always get a good cup of Midwestern common sense. So join us in this journey for independent journalism. And we'll see you next time on the Chicago Way on WGN+.